it in here the other day after discovering fresh batteries in the basement. What are you doing? Jacob asked.
Music.
I don't need music. I'd rather just talk.
I need music. And a drink. You need a drink, too.
Finally, something got through to him. He said, I'd kill for a drink. He made the harsh barking sound again, the one that seemed to stand for laughter. He could have shot her already, if her death was all he wanted, but it wasn't.
Part of him wanted more. A last kiss, a last fuck, a last drink, or maybe something deeper. Forgiveness, absolution.
Harper wasn't inclined to let him have any of it, but was happy to let him hope.
It was keeping her alive.
She turned on the FM. The classic rock station was playing an oldie but a goodie. A love-struck Romeo was getting ready to start the serenade. You and me, babe, how about it?
And for no reason at all, Harper thought of Hillary Clinton.
She stood in front of the soundbox, moving her hips from side to side. She didn't doubt that Jacob currently regarded sex with disgust, but he wasn't the only one who had taken some psychology courses in college. She hadn't forgotten what lay just across the border from disgust. She kept her back to him for maybe 10 seconds, pretending to be lost in the music, then cast a slow look over her shoulder. His gaze was fixed raptly upon her.
You hurt me, she said. You threw me down.
I'm sorry. That was across the line.
Except in the bedroom, she said.
He narrowed his eyes, and she knew she had pushed it too far, had strained his credulity. She never talked that way about sex. But before he could speak, she said, Our bottle! As if she were just remembering.
I want to have that bottle of wine we brought back from France. Remember? You said it was the best you ever had, and we should save it for something important.
She gave him what she hoped was a wry look and said, Is this important enough? The wines were all there in the study with them, the whites in the cooler that wasn't keeping them cool anymore, the reds in the cupboard. Whenever they went somewhere, they bought a bottle of wine, the way other people bought fridge magnets. They hadn't gone so many places, though, in the last few years. She grabbed for the honeymoon French Bordeaux, and her palm was so damp with sweat, it almost slipped out of her grasp and flew across the room at him. She imagined him jumping in surprise and shooting her in the stomach, just out of reflex, killing her and the baby in one shot, which, when she thought about it, would be perfectly in keeping with Jacob's character. He was parsimonious by nature, hated waste. He had often scolded her for using too much milk in her cereal. She pinned the bottle between her body and her right arm and took 2 wine goblets from where they hung under one of the bookshelves. The deep crystal glasses clinked musically together while her hands trembled. She got the corkscrew. Her plan was to use it to pull the cork, then ask him to pour the wine. And while he was pouring it, she would wiggle the cork off the screw and stab him in the face. Or, if she didn't have the stomach for that, she would at least try to impale him in the back of the hand that held the gun. She sat down on the edge of the coffee table, facing him and the great egg. The gun rested on his knee, the barrel pointing at her, but without any particular intention. She had the corkscrew in her right hand, twisted point sticking between her middle and ring fingers. He was a long way off. She would have to throw herself at him to get the corkscrew into his face. But maybe he would be closer when he poured the wine. Maybe. Then she shifted her gaze to his eyes and saw him staring at her with icy speculation. His face was pale and still and nearly expressionless.
Do you think if you get me drunk and fuck me, it'll change my mind about what has to happen? He asked her.
She said, I thought getting drunk and making love and having a good time was the whole idea. Doing it on our terms. Isn't that what you wanted?
It is. But I'm still not clear that's what you want. I don't know if that's what you ever wanted. Maybe in some vapid lifetime movie sense, you like the idea of pulling a Romeo and Juliet and dying side by side, but you were never really committed. You never thought it would happen. Now it's time. And you'll do anything to get out of it, including whore yourself.
He rocked back and forth and then said, I know it's politically incorrect to say, but what the hell, we're both about to die.
I've never thought much of the intelligence of women. I've never once met a woman who had any true intellectual rigor. There's a reason things like Facebook and airplanes and all the other great inventions of our time were made by men.
Yeah, she said, so they could get laid. Are we going to drink this wine or what?
He made the barking sound again. You're not even going to deny it?
Which part? The part about how women are stupid? Or the part about how I don't really want to kill myself with you?
The part where you think you can shake your ass and make me forget what I came here to do.
Because it's getting done.
If nothing else, I have a moral obligation to stop you from going out in the world and infecting someone else like you infected me.
Thought you said the world was going to end, so what would it matter? What would it...
But she couldn't talk anymore. Something awful was happening. The cork wouldn't come out of the bottle. It was a fat cork, sealed with dribbles of wax, and she had the bottle under her arm and was pulling at the corkscrew with the other hand, but the cork wouldn't give in the slightest, felt fixed in place. He reached across the table with his left hand and caught the neck of the bottle and tugged it out from under her arm. His right hand continued to grip the gun.
I told you these needed to be kept someplace dry, he said. The cork swells. I told you it was a mistake to just stick the reds in the cabinet.
I told you had to be some kind of karmic opposite to the words, I love you. He had always found it much easier to say, I told you. It would have been something to resent if she didn't feel all the breath go out of her. Because now Jacob had the corkscrew. She let him take it without a struggle, without an objection, the only weapon she had. He squeezed the bottle between his thighs, hunched and pulled. His neck reddened and cords stood out in it. Those fat blobs of wax split and the cork began to move. She looked at the gun. He still held it with his free hand, but it shifted a titch, to point more toward the bookshelf behind her.
Get your glass, he said. It's coming.
She picked up her goblet and scooched forward, so her knees bumped his. Time began to move in small, careful increments. The cork moved another centimeter, and another, and came out with a perfect little pop. He exhaled and set the corkscrew down by his knee, where she couldn't reach it.
Have a taste, he said,
and spilled a trickle into her outstretched glass. Jacob had taught her how to drink wine when they were in France, had instructed her in the subject with great enthusiasm. She stuck her nose into the cavern of the glass and inhaled, filled her nostrils with peppery fumes so strong it was possible to imagine getting drunk off them alone. It smelled good, but instead she flinched and frowned. Oh, damn it, does everything have to be wrong? She lifted her gaze. It went over. It's complete vinegar. Do we get another one? We've got that one from Napa. The one you said all the collectors want.
What? It's not even 10 years old. That doesn't seem right. Let me see.
He bent toward her, coming halfway out of the egg. His eyes widened the instant before she moved. He was quick, almost quick enough to duck out of the way. But that little lean was all she needed. She smashed the glass into his face. The goblet shattered with a pretty tuneful sound, and glass fangs tore open the skin in bright red lines, carving across his cheekbone, the bridge of his nose, and his eyebrow. It looked like a tiger cub had swiped at his face. He screamed and lifted the gun, and it went off. The sound of it was a shattering slam, right next to her head. A shelf of books behind her exploded, and the air filled with a snowstorm of flying pages. Harper came to her feet, pitching herself to her left, toward the door to the bedroom. She smashed a knee against the edge of the coffee table, coming around it, registered the impact, but felt no pain. An awesome silence gathered around her. The only noise in it, a high-pitched whining, the sound of a struck tuning fork. A torn sheet of paper, part of some book, floated down and caught against her chest, stuck there. The recoil flipped the grave egg straight back, with Jacob still in it. The bottle flew as he fell backwards, sailed across the room, and clubbed her in the shoulder. She kept going, crossed the den in 3 steps, and reached the door to the bedroom. The doorframe exploded to the left of her ear, throwing white chunks of wood into her hair, into her face. The sound of the gun going off was so muffled, it was like hearing a car door slam in the street. Then she was through, into the bedroom, She snatched thoughtlessly at the sheet of paper stuck to her chest, pulled it back, stared down at it, saw a handful of words. His hands were the hands of some amazing conductor, playing all the symphonies of blazing and burning to bring down the tatters and charcoal ruins of history. She flung it aside, behind her, back into the den, and slammed the door after it. 15. There was a lock on the door that she didn't bother with. No point. It was a button lock, and he'd kick right through it. She wasn't even sure the door would stay shut, half the door frame missing where a bullet had smashed into it. She grabbed the wooden chair to the left of the door and flung it down, something to put in the way. Her carpet bag was at the foot of the bed, clothes stacked inside, under the portable mother. She caught it by the leather handles and kept going, onto the window that looked over the backyard. She flicked the lock and shoved it up. Behind her, the chair shattered with a muffled crunch. The hill behind the house dropped steeply, a long grade that led down to the trees. The bedroom appeared to be on the first floor, if you were looking at the house from the front. But when you came around back, it was possible to see the bedroom was really on the second floor. A finished walk-in basement was beneath it. From the bedroom window, it was a 15-foot drop into darkness. As she threw her legs over the sill, she looked down and saw she was pouring blood, the whole front of her white halter soaked with it. She couldn't feel where she had been hit. She couldn't take time to think about it. She jumped, dragging her bag. The window exploded outward behind her as Jacob put a bullet in it. She fell and expected to hit the ground and didn't, and fell some more. Her stomach flipped inside her. Then she hit, her right foot folding under her with a breathtaking flash of pain. She thought of pianos falling in silent movies, shattering on impact, ivory keys spilling over the sidewalk like so many scattered teeth. Harper lunged off balance, fell forward, hit the dirt, rolled and rolled and rolled. She lost her grip on the carpet bag. It tumbled along with her, flinging its contents into the darkness. Her right ankle felt as if it had been shattered, but it couldn't be shattered, because if it was, Jacob would catch her, and he would kill her. She flopped to a halt two-thirds of the way down the steep slope, the smoke-filled night sky whirling overhead. At one edge of her vision, she could see her tall, narrow house looming over her. At the other, she could see the edge of the woods, the trees half-shed of their leaves, skeletons in rags. All she wanted to do was lie there and wait for the world to stop moving. But there wasn't time for that. It would take him all of 20 seconds to get down the stairs into the basement and out the back door. She pushed herself up. The ground tilted precariously beneath her, felt as unsteady as a dock floating on a turbulent lake. She wondered if some of the dizziness was blood loss, looked at her soaked blouse, at the deep red stain down the front of it, and smelled wine. He had not put a bullet in her after all. It was the honeymoon Bordeaux. She was wearing it. All of France's wine country was nothing but ash now, which meant the stain on her blouse was probably worth a few $1,000s on the black market. She had never worn anything so expensive. Harper put her left hand on the ground to steady herself and planted it on some shirts and something wrapped in crinkly plastic. The slide whistle. God knew why she had packed it. She shoved herself up and off the ground. Harper left her carpet bag and her scattered clothes and the portable mother, but she held on to the slide whistle. She took her first step toward the woods, and her right leg nearly folded underneath her. Something grated, and there was a flash of pain so intense her knees buckled. She might not be shot, but she had fractured something in her ankle. There was no doubt about it. "Harper!" Jacob screamed from up the hill behind her. "Stop running! Harper, you bitch!" The fractured bone in her ankle grated again, and a flash of pain, brilliant and white, went off behind her eyes. For a moment she was running blind and close to crumpling, passing out. In action movies, people dropped out of windows all the time, and it was no big deal. As she ran, she found herself pulling at the cellophane wrap on the slide whistle. It was thoughtless, automatic action, her hands operating of their own accord. On her next step, she put too much weight on the right foot, and the ankle folded, and she screamed weakly, couldn't help it.
A spoke of withering pain lanced straight from her ankle into her pelvis. She went down on one knee, behind some scrubby hemlocks. She lifted the whistle and blew, pulling out the slide, so it made a shrill, out-of-place carnival sound in the forest. It was loud. That first gunshot had done something to her ears, bruised her eardrums and muffled her hearing. But the slide whistle cut right through it, loud as a bottle rocket whining away into the night.
"Harper, you bitch! My face! Look what you did to my face!"
Jacob roared. He was closer now, almost to the woods. Harper pushed herself up again. She staggered deeper in among the trees, holding a hand up in front of her to protect her face from branches. Every time she put weight on her right foot, it was like her ankle breaking all over again. Sweet, crisp leaves crunched beneath her heels. She was scared now, as scared as she could ever remember being in her life, and the sound of her fear was the wheeeoop of a penny whistle slicing through the night. She didn't know why she was blowing it again. It would lead Jacob right to her. She loped jaggedly off course. No, that wasn't right. For her to wander off course, she needed to have a course, and she had no idea where she was going. The penny whistle fell from her hand, and she went on without looking back. She put her right foot in a soft depression and wrenched her ankle again and cried out softly and fell to one knee.
"I'm coming, Harper!"
Jacob yelled, and he made the barking sound of laughter.
"Wait till you see what I'm going to do to your face!"
Harper reached out, blindly, to the right, for a tree trunk that remained stubbornly out of reach. She was in danger of falling onto her side. If that happened, she wouldn't be able to get up. She would be lying there, curled in the fetal position, gasping for breath, when Jacob found her and began pumping bullets into her. Leaves crackled and someone took her hand. She opened her mouth to cry out, and the sound caught in her throat. She stared up into Captain America's stoic, blank face. "Come on," said Cap in a girl's voice, and she hauled Harper to her feet. They hurried along the edge of the forest, holding hands, the bald girl showing Harper the way. Her feet hardly seemed to touch the ground, and Harper felt again what she had felt when they first met, that this wasn't happening. This was being dreamt. The girl led Harper to an oak that had probably been old when Kennedy was shot. There were boards nailed into the trunk, leading up into the branches, remnant of some long-forgotten treehouse. Harper thought of the lost boys, thought of Peter Pan. "Up," the girl whispered. "Quick!" "Quickly," said the fireman, as he came out of the bushes from Harper's right. His face was so filthy it was nearly black, and he was wearing his big fireman's helmet and sooty yellow coat, and the halligan swung from one hand. "Proper usage, Allie. Try not to distort my language with your horrible Americanisms." And he grinned. "He's coming," Allie said. "I'll send him on his way," said the fireman. Jacob cursed from somewhere close by. Harper could hear him crashing through the brush. She climbed into the tree, using her right knee instead of her foot. It wasn't easy, and the girl was right behind her, shoving at her ass with both hands. "Will you hurry up?" Allie hissed. "I busted my ankle," Harper said, reaching for a wide branch above her and pulling herself onto it. She hitched her rear to one side, sliding out across the branch to make room for the girl. They were about 12 feet off the ground, and Harper could see through the leaves of the oak to the small open area below. The fireman did not go far, just a few steps in the direction of Jacob's crashing noises. Then he positioned himself behind a sumac and waited. A breeze, smelling faintly of bonfires, lifted and tossed Harper's hair. She turned her face into it and realized she could see her house through the trees. By daylight, she would have a good view of her own back deck and the windows into the kitchen from here. Jacob spilled from the bushes, going past the fireman without seeing him. Jacob's face was bleeding. The laceration below his left eye was particularly bad, a flap of skin wobbling and hanging down over his cheekbone. He had leaves in his hair and a fresh scrape on his chin. He carried the gun low, at his side, barrel pointed toward the forest floor. "Oi," said the fireman. "Why are you running about with a gun? Someone could get hurt. I hope you have the safety on." Jacob made a sound,
a little cry of surprise that was also like a sharp, indrawn breath, and turned, lifting the revolver. The fireman brought the Halligan down, that long, rusty bar, with tools bristling from either end. It whistled in the air and struck the barrel of the gun with a clang. The pistol dropped and thudded to the ground and went off, and the flash lit the forest.
"No, I guess not," said the fireman. "Who the fuck are you?" Jacob asked. "You with Harper?"
The fireman cocked his head to one side and seemed to consider this for a moment, his eyes puzzled. Then his face brightened, and he opened his mouth in a generous, toothy grin.
"Yes, I suppose I am," he said, and rocked back on his heels, as if this were something he had only just realized and found delightful.
It came to Harper, then, that he was crazy, as crazy as Jacob.
Harper. Like Harper Lee, I imagine. I only knew her as Nurse Grayson. Harper. Wonderful name.
He cleared his throat and added, "I suppose I'm also the man telling you to sod off. These woods don't belong to you."
"Who the fuck do you think they belong to?" Jacob asked.
"Me," said the fireman.
"I fucking think they fucking belong the fuck to me. I can swear too, mate. I'm English. We swear without fear. The C-word? We say that too. Cunt, 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 cunt."
Without dropping the grin, he said, "Go on now. Get lost, you loud-mouthed cunt." Jacob stared at the fireman warily, seemed genuinely not to know what to say or what to do. Then he turned and bent over, reaching for his gun. The fireman lashed out with the Halligan, using it like a polo stick, striking the pistol and knocking it away into the ferns. Jacob did not hesitate, but pivoted and threw himself at the thin, wiry Englishman. The fireman lifted the Halligan, bringing it up between them, but then Jacob had his hands on it, and they were wrestling over it, and Jacob was the stronger man. Stronger, and he had better balance. That sense of balance that carried him across tight ropes and allowed him to perch comfortably on a unicycle. He set his feet and twisted at the waist, lifting the fireman right off the ground, swinging him half a foot through the air and slamming him into the trunk of the very oak Harper sat in. Harper felt the force of the impact shake the tree branch beneath her, felt the whole tree shudder. Jacob pulled the bar back a few inches and slammed the fireman into the tree again. The fireman grunted, and all the air shot out of him, a whistling exhalation through his nostrils.
"You motherfucker," Jacob was saying, almost chanting. "I'll kill you, motherfucker. I'll kill you, and I'll kill her, and I'll..."
His voice trailed off. He had run out of people to kill. He slammed the fireman into the tree again, and the fireman's helmet cracked loudly against the trunk. Harper flinched and caught a shout in her throat. Allie, though, had her hand on her knee, and she squeezed it.
"Watch," she whispered.
She had pulled the mask down around her neck, and Harper saw a beauty. Chocolate eyes that glittered with hilarity, tomboy freckles, and delicate features that seemed even sharper and clearer because her head was shaved smooth, to better show the hollows of her temples and her fine bones.
"Look at his hand."
And Harper saw that the fireman's bare left hand was boiling with gray smoke. The left hand had let go of the Halligan bar and dropped to the fireman's side. Harper flashed to a memory. The fireman wrestling with Albert in the hallway off the emergency room and trying to yank his glove off with his teeth. Jacob pulled back on the Halligan bar, meaning to drive the fireman into the tree trunk again. But at that moment the fireman reached over the bar and put his hand on Jacob's throat, and fire belched from his palm. That flame was as blue as a blowtorch. The fireman's hand wore a glove of radiant fire. The blaze roared like a rising wind, and Jacob screamed and let go of the Halligan and fell away. He screamed again, grabbing at his blackened throat. His feet got tangled, and he went straight down on his ass, and then he sprang up once more and ran, heaving himself blindly through the branches and brush. The fireman watched him go, his left hand a torch. Then he opened his filthy yellow turnout jacket, put his burning hand under it, and clapped the jacket shut, trapping his hand between the coat and his shirt. He opened the jacket and shut it, and opened it again, beating at his hand calmly. He looked rather like a child trying to use his armpit to make farts. And the third time he opened the jacket, The flame had gone out, and the hand was spewing filthy black smoke. He waved the hand in the air, letting the smoke boil off it. In the distance, Harper could hear branches snapping and brush crackling, the sound of Jacob running away. In another moment, the woods were quiet, except for the alien chirp of night insects. The fireman held up his left hand, drew a deep breath, and blew away the last of the smoke. His palm was sketched with dragon scale. Those fine, delicate black lines were ashed over now, the surface snow-white, with a few sparks nested here and there, glowing faintly. The rest of the skin covering his hand was fine, clean and healthy and pink and impossibly unburned. Allie said, "I love it when he does that, but his best trick is when he makes a phoenix. It's better than fireworks." "True enough," said the fireman, turning his head and grinning cheekily up at them. "I put the 5th of November and the 4th of July to shame. Who needs Roman candles when you've got me?" Book 2. Let Your Dim Light Shine. 1. Allie was first out of the tree, grabbing the branch and swinging to the ground. Harper meant to go down by way of the rudimentary ladder nailed into the trunk, but as soon as she slid off the branch she had been sitting on, she dropped. The fireman was there to break her fall. He didn't exactly catch her. He just happened to be below her when she went down. She flattened him under her, and they hit the dirt together. The back of her head smashed him in the nose. Her right heel bounced off the ground. The pain that shot through her ankle was exquisite. They groaned in each other's arms, like lovers. "Fuck," she said. "Fuck, fuck, fuck!" "Is that the best you can do?" the fireman asked. He was holding his nose and blinking back tears. "Just a lot of fuck, 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 over and over again. Can't you expand your range a little? Goddamn bloody ass foam. Daddy drilling mommy on the kitchen table. That sort of thing. Americans curse without any imagination at all." Harper sat up, her shoulders hitching with her first sobs. Her legs were trembling and her ankle was broken, and Jacob had nearly killed her, had wanted to kill her. And people were shooting guns and bursting into flame, and she had fallen out of a tree, and the baby... and she couldn't help herself. The fireman sat up next to her and put an arm around her, and she rested her head on the slippery shoulder of his jacket. "There, there," he said. And he held her for a bit, while she had a good, unglamorous cry. When her sobs had subsided to hiccups, he said, "Let's get you up. We should be going. We don't know what your deranged ex-husband might be up to. I wouldn't put it past him to call a quarantine patrol." "He's not my ex. We're not divorced." "You are now, by the power vested in me." "What power vested in you?" "You know how captains of ships can marry people. Little known fact, firemen can divorce people as well. Come on, up with you." The fireman encircled her waist with his left arm and hoisted her to her feet. The hand on her hip was still warm, like fresh bread from the oven. "You set your hand on fire," she said. "How did you do that?" On the face of it, she already knew the answer. He had dragon scale, same as her. His hand was still uncovered, and she could see a black and gold scrawl tracing the lines of his palm, running in a coil around and around his wrist. A fine gray smoke trickled from the thicker lines. She had seen at least 100 people with dragon scale ignite and begin to scream, blue fire racing over them as if they were painted in kerosene, their hair erupting in a flash. It was not something anyone wanted or could do to themselves, and when it happened it was not controlled, and it always ended in death. But the fireman had consciously lit himself up, and only part of himself, just his hand. Then he had calmly put himself back out again, and somehow he had not been hurt. "I thought about offering a class once," the fireman said, "but I couldn't figure out what I was teaching. Advanced pyromancy? Spontaneous combustion for dummies? Arson 101? Besides, it's hard to get people to sign up for a course when failing a test means burning alive." "That's a lie," Allie said. "He won't teach you. He won't teach anyone. Liar, liar, pants on fire." "No, not tonight, Allie."
This is my favorite pair of dungarees, and I can't afford to burn them up just because you want me to show off.
You've been spying on me, Harper said.
The fireman glanced up into the branches of the oak, where she had been perched only a moment before.
There's an excellent view of your bedroom from up there. Isn't it odd how people with something to hide will pull the curtains at the front of the house, but never think to cover the windows out back?
You spend a lot of time wandering around in your underwear, reading what to expect when you're expecting, Allie said.
Don't worry. He never peeped through your windows at you while you were getting dressed. Maybe I did once or twice, but not him. He's a proper English gentleman, is what he is.
Allie's faux English accent was at least as good as Dick Van Dyke's in Mary Poppins. If Harper had been a 16-year-old boy, she would have been mad for her. You could just tell she was the best kind of trouble.
Why? Harper asked the fireman. Why spy on me?
Allie, the fireman said, as if he had not heard Harper's question. Run on ahead to camp. Bring your grandfather and Ben Patchett. Oh, and find Renee. Tell Renee we have acquired her favorite nurse. She'll be so pleased.
Then Allie was gone, springing into leaves in a way that made Harper think of Peter Pan's shadow zinging around Wendy's bedroom.
Harper had a head crammed full of children's books and could be quite compulsive about assigning people storybook roles. When the girl was gone, the fireman said,
Just as well to have you to myself for a moment, Nurse Grayson. I trust Allie's story with my life, but there are some things I'd rather not say in front of her. Do you know the summer camp at the end of Little Harbor Road?
Camp Wyndham, Harper said.
Sure.
Dead leaves crunched underfoot, and their smell sugared the air with autumn's perfume.
That's where we're headed. There's a fella there, Tom Story, Allie's grandfather. They call him Father Story. Once upon a time, Tom was the program director at the camp. Now he has the place opened up as a shelter for folk with dragon scale. He's got more than 100 people hiding there, and they've banged together a decent little society. There's 3 meals a day, for now, anyway. I don't know how much longer that will last. There's no electric power, but they've got working showers, if you can stand being pelted by ice water. They've got a school, and a kind of junior police force called the Lookouts, to keep watch for quarantine patrols and cremation crews. That's mostly teenagers, the Lookouts. Allie and her friends. Gives them something to do. They have all the religion you could possibly want, too. In some ways, it isn't like any religion that's ever come before. And in other ways, well, fundamentalists are much the same wherever you go. That's one of the things I wanted to forewarn you about while Allie ran on ahead. She's even more devout than most, and that's saying quite a lot.
There was a rending crack, a sliding, reverberating crash that shook the forest floor and caused Harper's pulse to leap. She stared back through the woods in the direction they had come from. She couldn't imagine what could possibly have made such an enormous, shattering noise. The fireman cast a brief, considering glance over his shoulder, then took her arm and began to move her along again, a little more briskly now. He continued as if there had been no interruption at all.
You have to understand that most of the camp is between your age and Allie's. There are a few oldsters, but a lot more who ought to still be in school. Most of them have lost family, seen the people they love burned to death in front of them. They were in shock when they found their way to camp, refugees, deranged by grief, and just waiting round to burst into flame themselves. Then Father Story and his daughter Carol, Allie's aunt, taught them they don't have to die. They've offered them hope when they had none and a very concrete form of salvation.
Harper slowed, in part to rest her sore ankle, in part to absorb what he was saying.
What do you mean? They're teaching people they don't have to die?
No one can teach someone with dragon scale not to die. That's impossible. If there was a treatment, some pill.
You aren't required to swallow anything, the fireman said. Not even their faith. Remember that, Nurse Grayson.
If there was anything that could prevent the dragon scale from killing people, the government would know by now. If there was something that worked, really worked, something that could extend the lives of millions of sick people, people with a lethal and contagious spore on their skin.
Nurse Grayson, no one wants us extending our lives. Nothing could be less desirable. Shortening them, that's what would best serve the public good. At least in the minds of the healthy population. One thing we know about people with dragon scale,
They don't burst into flame if you shoot them in the head. You don't have to worry about a corpse infecting you or your children, or starting a conflagration that might take out a city block. She opened her mouth to protest, and he squeezed her shoulder. There'll be time to argue this point later. Although I warn you, it's been argued before, most notably by poor Harold Cross. I feel his case largely settles the matter.
Harold Cross?
He shook his head. Leave it for now. I only want you to understand that Tom and Carol have given these people more than food or shelter, or even a way to suppress their illness. They've given them belief in each other, in the future, and in the power they share as a flock. A flock isn't such a bad thing if you belong, but a few hundred starlings will tear an unlucky marten to feathers if it crosses their path. I think Camp Wyndham could be a very unfriendly place for an apostate. Tom, he's tolerant enough. He's your inclusive, modern, thoughtful religious type, an ethics professor by trade. But his daughter, Allie's aunt, she's barely more than a kid herself, and most of the other kids have made a kind of cult around her. She sings the songs, after all. You want to stay on her good side. She's kind enough, Carol is. Means well. But if she doesn't love you, then she's afraid of you. And she's dangerous when she's afraid. I am uneasy in my mind about what might happen if Carol ever felt seriously threatened. I'm not going to threaten anyone, Harper said. He smiled. No, you don't strike me as the type to make trouble, but to make peace. I still haven't forgotten the first time you crossed my path, Nurse Grayson. You saved his life, you know, Nick. And you saved my skull while you were at it. I seem to remember it was just about to be kicked in when you intervened. I owe you. Not anymore, Harper said. Ahead of them, in the dark, branches rustled and were pushed aside. A modest assembly emerged, Allie leading the way. The girl was breathing hard and had a pretty flush of color on her delicate features. What happened, John? Asked a man standing directly behind her. His voice was low and melodious, and even before she saw Tom Story's face, Harper liked him. At first, she could make out little more than his gold-rimmed spectacles flashing in the darkness. Who do we have here? Someone useful, the fireman said, only now she knew his name. John. A nurse, a Miss Grayson. Can you take her the rest of the way? I'm no doctor, but I think she fractured her ankle. If you'll help her along to the infirmary, I'd like to go back and collect her things while there's still time. My guess is there'll soon be police and a quarantine patrol swarming her place. Gee, can I help? Said one of the other members of the greeting party. He stepped forward, slipping easily between the fireman and Harper, and put his arm around her waist. Harper slung hers over his shoulders. He was a big man, maybe quarter of a century older than Harper, with sloping shoulders and pale silver hair beginning to thin up top. Harper thought of an aged and well-loved Paddington bear. Ben Patchett, he said. Glad to meet you, ma'am. There was a woman with them, too, short, squashy, her silver hair braided into cornrows. She smiled tentatively, perhaps unsure Harper would remember her. Of course, there was no chance at all Harper could have forgotten the woman who fled Portsmouth Hospital, shimmering as brightly as a flare and just as sure to explode. Renee Gilmanton, Harper said. I thought you ran away to die somewhere.
That's what I thought, too. Father Story had other ideas.
Renee put an arm under Harper's armpits, helping to support her from the other side.
You took such good care of me for so long, Nurse Grayson. What a pleasure to have a chance to tend to you for a bit. How'd you bust your ankle? Father Story asked, lifting his chin so the dim light flashed on the lenses of his spectacles.
And for the first time Harper could see his features, his long, skinny, deeply lined face and silver beard, and she thought, Dumbledore. The beard was actually less Dumbledore, more Hemingway, but the eyes behind the lenses of his glasses were a brilliant shade of blue that naturally suggested a man who could cast runes and speak to trees. Harper found it hard to reply, didn't know yet how to speak of Jacob and what he had tried to do to her. The fireman seemed to see in a glance how the question defeated her, and answered himself.
Her husband came for her with a gun. I chased him off. That's all. Time is short, Tom.
Isn't it always? Father Story replied. The fireman started to turn away, then pivoted back and pressed something into Harper's hand. Oh, you dropped this, nurse. Do keep it on you. If you ever need me again, just blow. It was her penny whistle. She had dropped it running from Jacob and forgotten all about it, and was absurdly grateful to have it returned. He doesn't slip everyone his slide whistle of love, Allie said. You're in.
Mind out of the gutter, Allie, the fireman said. What would your mother have said?
Something dirtier, Allie said. Come on, let's go get the nurse's gear. Allie dropped the Captain America mask back over her face and bounded into the trees. The fireman cursed under his breath and began to hurry after her, using that great iron pole of his to swat aside the underbrush.
Allie! Father Story cried. Allie, please, come back!
But she was already gone.
That girl has no business mixing herself up in John's work, said Ben Patchett.
Try and stop her, Renee said.
The fireman, John, he lit himself on fire, Harper said. His whole hand burst into flame. How'd he do that?
Fire is the devil's only friend, Ben Patchett said and laughed. Isn't that right, Father?
I don't know if he's a devil, said Father Story. But if he is, he's our devil.
Still, I wish Allie wouldn't go with him. Does she want to get herself killed like her mother? Sometimes it almost seems she's daring the world to try.
Oh, Father, said Renee, you raised two teenage girls. If anyone understood Allie, I'd think it would be you.
She looked off into the woods in the direction Allie had disappeared in.
Of course she's daring the world to try.
2.
It was barely a mile to Camp Wyndham, but it seemed to Harper they were tromping after Father Story through the weary, stifling darkness for hours. They wallowed in drifts of leaves, wove in and around pine trees, clambered over a pile of rocks, always moving toward the briny scent of the Atlantic. Her ankle thrummed. Harper did not ask where they were, and Father Story did not say. Not long after they started moving, he popped something into his mouth. It was the size of a blue jay's egg, and after that made no sound. They emerged alongside Little Harbor Road, looking across the blacktop at the turnoff into Camp Wyndham, a lane of hard-packed white shell and sandy earth. The entrance was barred by a chain hung between a pair of tall standing boulders that would not have looked out of place at Stonehenge. Beyond, the land mounded up in green hills. Even at night, Harper could see the white steeple of a church sticking up over the ridge a half mile away. The burned-out and blackened hull of a bus was parked off the road, just past those totemic blocks of granite. It was up to its iron rims in weeds and had been baked down almost to the frame. Before they crossed the road, Father Story clapped twice. The four of them hobbled up out of the brush and crossed the blacktop to the sandy lane. A boy descended the steps of the bus to stand in the open doorway and watch them approach. Father Story removed the white egg from his mouth and glanced back at Harper and her human crutches.
The bus may look like a wreck, but it isn't quite. The headlights work. If someone unknown were to come up our road, a boy in the bus would wait for our visitors to move out of sight, then flash a signal. Another boy in the steeple of the church keeps a lookout for it. The eye in the steeple sees all the people.
He smiled at this, then added, If necessary, we can get into hiding in 2 minutes. We drill every day. Credit to Ben Patchett. This inspiration is his. My own ideas involved a fantastical system of bird whistles and the possible use of kites.
The boy in the bus had a beard that made Harper think of Vikings, a stiff coil of braided orange wires. But the face behind the beard was young and soft. Harper doubted he was any older than Allie. He lazily twirled a nightstick in one hand.
I guess I misunderstood the plan, Father, the boy said. I thought you were off to bring us a nurse, not someone who needs a nurse.
His gaze shifted from one face to another, and he smiled in a worried sort of way.
I don't see Allie.
We heard a thunderous crash, a stupendous roar of mindless violence and senseless destruction, Father Story told him. Naturally, Allie ran straight toward it.
Try not to worry, Michael. She has the fireman with her.
Michael nodded, then dipped his head toward Harper in a way that was almost courtly. His eyes shone with the fevered innocence of someone who has been saved.
Hello to you. We're all friends here, nurse. This is where your life begins again.
She smiled back at him, but couldn't think how to reply, and in another moment it was too late, Ben and Renee shuttling her along. When Harper looked back, the boy had vanished into the bus. Father Story was about to put the gumball back in his mouth, then saw Harper looking at it.
Ah, bit of a compulsion of mine. Something I picked up reading Samuel Beckett. I stick a pebble in my mouth to remind myself to be quiet and listen now and then. I taught in a private school for decades, and with all these young people wandering about, the urge to deliver impromptu lectures is very strong.
They followed the winding lane through leafy darkness, past a dry swimming pool and a riflery range where brass cartridges glittered dully amid dead leaves. All seemed long abandoned, an appearance maintained at some effort, Harper learned later. At last they reached the top of the hill. A soccer pitch lay on the other side of the slope in a shallow, grassy cup below them. Children yelled and chased a ball that glowed a pale, eerie green, the color of a ghost. Beyond that, through the trees, loomed a long boathouse and the heaving blackness of the sea. The chapel was on the right, set back from the road. It was placed on the far side of a sculpture garden of mossy dolmens and tall monoliths. The monument park was an odd, primitive sort of thing to find guarding the way to a perfectly modern-looking church with a tall steeple and bright red doors. The church might be a place of worship, but the sculpture garden looked more a place of sacrifice. What caught Harper's attention in particular was a knot of 6 teenagers sitting on logs at one corner of a vast barn of a building that turned out to be the cafeteria. They were gathered around a campfire that burned a peculiar shade of ruby gold, as if the flames were shining through red crystal. A slim-shouldered beauty swayed in the undulating crimson light, strumming a ukulele. At first glance, she might have been Allie's twin, but no, she was older, mid-20s maybe. Her head was shaved too, although she had preserved a single black lock of hair, like a comma, on her brow. The aunt, Harper guessed. She led the others on a sing-along, their voices lacing together like lovers' fingers. They sang an old U2 number, sang about how they were one but not the same, and how they would carry each other. As Harper went by, the woman with the uke lifted her gaze and smiled, and her eyes were as bright as gold coins. And that was when Harper saw there was no campfire at all. It was them making the light. They were all of them tattooed with loops and whorls of dragon scale, which glowed like fluorescent paint under a black light, hallucinatory hues of cherry wine and blowtorch blue. When they opened their mouths to sing, Harper glimpsed light painting the insides of their throats, as if each of them were a kettle filled with embers. Harper felt she had never seen anything so frightening or beautiful. She shivered and for a moment was conscious of her body beneath her clothes, and a feeling like fingers gently tracing the lines of dragon scale on her skin. She swayed with a sudden giddy lightheadedness. "They're shining," Harper muttered, a little thickly. Her head was filled with their song, and it was hard to push a thought through it.
"You will too," Ben Patchett promised her, "in time."
"Is it dangerous?" Harper breathed. "Can they catch fire doing that?" Father Story popped the stone out of his mouth and said,
"The dragon scale is like anything that makes fire, Nurse Grayson. You can use it to burn a place down, or light your way to something better. No one dies of spontaneous combustion in Camp Wyndham."
"You've beaten it?" Harper asked.
"Better," Father Story said. "We've made friends with it."
3. Harper sprang shuddering to consciousness from an ugly dream, twisting in her bedsheets. Carol Story leaned over her, a hand on her wrist. "You're all right. Breathe." Harper nodded. She was woozy, her pulse rapping so hard it made her vision flash. She wondered how long she had slept. She remembered being half-carried up the steps into an infirmary, recalled Ben Patchett and Renee Gilmanton following her careful instructions as they set her ankle and bound it in rolls of gauze. She dimly remembered Renee bringing her lukewarm water and some gel tabs of acetaminophen, remembered the older woman's dry, cool hand on her forehead and worried, watching gaze.
"What were you dreaming?" Carol asked. Do you remember? Carol Story had enormous, wondering eyes, with irises of chocolate, flecked with gold speckles of dragon scale. Hoops of gold and ebony circled her wrists, and she wore a short t-shirt that rode up to show crossed belts of the scale above her hips. It gave her the look of a goth gunslinger. Where her skin was unmarked, it was pale almost to the point of translucency. She was so delicate, it looked as though if she stumbled and fell, she might shatter, like a ceramic vase. Harper's breasts were sore. There was a dry spoke of heat in her fractured ankle, and her thoughts were muddled and slow with the dregs of a deep sleep. My husband wrote a book. I dropped it. The pages went everywhere, and I think I was trying to put it all back in order before he got home. I didn't want him to know I had been reading it. There had been more. More and worse. But it was already slipping away, dropping out of sight, like a stone kicked into deep water. I thought I'd better wake you, Carol said. You were shivering and making these awful noises and, well, smoking a little. I was? Harper asked. She realized she could smell a faint odor of char, as if someone had burned a few pine needles. Only a little. Carol gazed at her with a look of pained apology. When you sighed, there'd be a blue puff. It's stress that does it. After you've learned to join the bright, that won't happen anymore. Once you're really one of us, part of the group, the dragon scale won't ever hurt you. It's hard to believe, but one day, you may even look at the scale as a blessing. In Carol's voice, Harper heard the innocent and utter belief of the fanatic, and was dismayed by it. She had learned from Jacob to think of people who spoke of blessings and faith as simple and a little infirm. People who thought things happened for a reason were to be pitied. Such folk had given up their curiosity about the universe for a comforting children's story. Harper could understand the impulse. She was a fan of children's stories herself, but it was one thing to spend a rainy Saturday afternoon reading Mary Poppins, and quite another to think she might actually turn up at your house to apply for the babysitting job. She did her best to appear blandly interested, but her distress must have showed. Carol rocked back in her chair and laughed. Was that a little too much, a little too fast? You're new here. I'll try and go easy on you. I warn you, though, in this joint, the lunatics really are running the asylum. What does the cat say to Alice in Wonderland? We're all mad here, Harper said, and smiled in spite of herself. Carol nodded. My father wanted me to take you around and show you the camp. Everyone wants to meet you. We're late for lunch, but Norma Held, who runs the cafeteria, promised to keep the kitchen open until we ate. Harper lifted her head and squinted out the windows into a darkness so complete she might have been underground. The infirmary's single wardroom had three cots, with curtains hung between them to create some privacy. She occupied the central bed. It had been dark when she dozed off, and was dark now, and she had not the slightest notion what time it might be. As if Harper had asked, Carol said, About 2 a.m. You slept through the whole day, which is just as well. We all live like vampires here. Up at sundown, back to the crypt at dawn. No one is drinking blood yet, but if we run out of canned goods, it's hard to say what will happen. Harper sat up, wincing. Just the fabric of her hoodie brushing against her sore, swollen breasts was enough to make them hurt, and discovered two things. The first was that one of the curtains was pushed back, and a boy sat on the next camp bed over. A boy she recognized. A boy with dark curly hair and delicate elfin features. The last she had seen him, he was suffering from acute appendicitis, his face greasy with sweat. No, that wasn't quite right. She supposed she had seen him more recently than that. It had surely been him at her door in the tiger mask with Allie. Now he sat cross-legged, watching her with the intentness of a child in front of a favorite television show. The second was that a radio was on, tuned to static. It sat on the counter, next to a plaster model of a human head, the skull removed to reveal the brain. Harper remembered the boy was deaf and moved her hand in a slow wave. In response, he reached behind his back, found a sheet of paper, and handed it to her. On it was a drawing, a little boy's drawing, although it showed skill.
of a large striped cat walking across green grass, tail in the air. "Temporary cat," read the words beneath the stalking feline. Harper gave him a quizzical look and a smile, but he was already sliding off the cot and trotting out.
"That's Nick, yes?" Harper asked.
"My nephew, yes. Odd Duck. It runs in the family."
"And John is his stepfather?"
"What?" Carol said, and it was impossible to miss the sudden edge in her voice.
"No, not at all. My sister and John Rockwood dated for a few months in a very different world. Nick's actual father is dead, and John, well, he barely registers in the boy's life anymore."
It seemed to Harper this was a little unkind, not to mention unfair, considering the fireman had carried Nick to the hospital in his arms and had been ready to fight security and everyone in line to get him treatment. Harper also knew when a topic was an unwelcome one. She left the subject of John Rookwood for another time and said, "Nick gave me a temporary cat. Why did he give me a temporary cat?"
"It's a thank you note. You were the nurse at the hospital who saved his life. That was an awful week. That was the most awful week of my life. I lost my sister. I thought I was going to lose my nephew. I knew we were going to be best friends, and I was going to be crazy for you, even before I met you, Harper. Because of what you did for Nick, I want us to have matching pajamas. That's how crazy I am for you. I wish I had a temporary cat to give you."
"If it's temporary, do I have to give it back?"
"No. It's only to tide you over until he can get you a real cat. He's hunting one. He's made some snares and complicated traps. He goes around with a net on a stick, like catching cats is the same as catching butterflies. He keeps bugging people to find him catnip. I'm not sure the one he's hunting is real. No one else has seen it. I'm starting to think it's like Snuffleupagus, Big Bird's friend, just in his head."
Harper said, "But Snuffleupagus was real."
"That is the most wonderful sentence I have ever heard. I want that on my gravestone. Snuffleupagus was real. No more. Just that."
Harper couldn't put her weight on her right foot, but Carol got an arm around her and helped her stand. As they hobbled past the radio on the counter, Carol reached out, hesitated a moment, and moved the dial slowly through bands of static. That anatomical model of a human head gaped at them in amazement. It was a grotesque thing, skin peeled away from one half of the face to show the sinew and nerves beneath, one eyeball suspended in a fibrous red nest of exposed muscle.
"What?" Harper asked. "Are you listening for something in particular?"
"Snuffleupagus," Carol said, and laughed, and switched the radio off. Harper waited for her to explain. She didn't.
4.
The cafeteria was perched on top of the hill, overlooking the soccer pitch and the pebbly beach below. Moss and strands of yellowing dead grass grew on the shingled roof, and the windows were boarded up, giving it a look of long disuse. The impression of abandonment was dispelled the moment Carol pushed open the door and led them into the seating area, a dim, cavernous space with exposed beams of red pine. Plates clattered in the kitchen, and the air was fragrant with the odor of marinara sauce and stewed pork. Lunch appeared to be over and done, but they didn't have the place entirely to themselves. Renee Gilmanton sat at a table for two, across from an old fella in a Greek fisherman's cap, both of them hunched over steaming coffees. A boy sat alone at the next table over, the kid who looked like a Viking. Michael, Harper remembered. He was forking up noodles in red sauce and turning the pages of an ancient Ranger Rick, reading by the light of a candle in a jelly jar. The evening before, Michael had come across as maybe 17. Now, bent over an article on Miami's marvelous manatees, his eyes wide with fascination, he looked like a 10-year-old in a fake beard. Renee lifted her chin and caught Harper's eye. It was a pleasure and a relief to have a friend here, to not be completely alone among strangers. Harper flashed back to other lunches in other cafeterias, and the anxiety that came with not seeing a familiar face and not knowing where to sit. She suspected Renee had waited around in hopes of meeting up with Harper and helping her to settle in, a small act of consideration for which Harper was indecently grateful. The serving counter was manned by Norma Held, a mountainous pile of flesh with the broad, sloping shoulders of a silverback gorilla. The post-meal cleanup was under